because, also, I see that you dost possess the gift of divination, and powers, which are of inestimable value to those who know how to use them. I would enroll you in my service, and train your gifts that they may be of use to you and me. You hast a thirst for knowledge, behold, I can give you knowledge beyond aught that you canst dream of now. I can reveal to your eyes mysteries that have been hid from all but the most favored few, and I can guide your steps upon the dark pathways of the netherworld, whereon only such bold spirits as you and I would dare to tread. All these things can I show to you, and in return I ask that for a season you shall serve me, to learn a secret, which concerns me much. And who art you who makest such boundless promises? How shall I know that you hast these powers, which you dost claim?
I am Jalal ad-Din, said he, haughtily. Some men call me the sorcerer, others the good doctor, others again the caster of magic spells. There are none within this city who would dare to doubt my power. I have long sought for one with gifts like unto your, and lo! When I beheld you upon the temple steps I came out to meet you.
Nay, answered I, impressed in spite of myself by his words, nay, but I see no visions now. For in truth I had seen none since my flight from the temple.
Had you no vision when you was under the trees? Said Jalal ad-Din, slowly fixing his dark eyes upon my face.
If you saw no vision, why, then, did you choose the southward path?
Now I know that you art in very truth a sorcerer, cried I, for I was alone upon the desert, no eyes beheld that vision but mine own. Where then was you?
In mine own chamber, gazing upon your star, and upon mine own. For your strange star drew near unto mine and then receded, and I put forth my will to draw you unto me, for I knew that the hour of our meeting was at hand.
Jalal ad-Din paused, and turning from me began to trace a figure on the ground with the point of his wand, while I, startled, bewildered, uncertain what to do, stood silently watching him. His words had awakened in me a most keen desire to know more of so extraordinary a man. The danger, which I instinctively felt lurked in such knowledge as he possessed, only made me the more eager to penetrate the mysteries of these unhallowed powers. I had heard of men who practiced forbidden arts, and possessed powers transcending in many respects those of even the most favored prophets of the oracles themselves, and my bold thoughts had many a time strayed longingly upon the forbidden path, for I desired with all my soul to raise even a corner of the dark veil, which hid the knowledge of these dangerous things. And Jalal ad-Din looked up at me and said, "It is because you think such knowledge as mine is of the powers of evil that you dost hesitate to answer me. Yet are not all things which are mysterious called by the unlearned evil? Is it not ignorance, which is the true evil, and cannot those who know how to do so pluck even from the poison flowers their sting, leaving behind only the harmless blossoms? Join me if you art willing for a time, but I seek in no way to tie you. I am no priest, to fear that you should steal the secrets of a temple, or tell to the world how full of frailty are these vaunted teachers of other men." He spoke in mingled accents of scorn and passion, and his eyes glowed with a fierce fire of hatred when he mentioned the temple. After a brief pause he added, "You hast shown thyself bold in the things which are of earth, be then as bold to search out the secrets which are not of earth. Yet I will urge you no more, for I have fulfilled my part in seeking speech with you, and if you art to join me, then must you seek me for thyself."
"Where shall I find you?" said I, "if I desire to join you when I have thought over all that you hast said."
"You shall find me in mine own house, all men know, which is the house of Jalal ad-Din. But if you seekest me it must be when the stars have climbed the sky, and night's dark mantle doth enshroud the earth." I assented to this, and bowing low to each other we parted, but ere Jalal ad-Din turned away, I saw that with his sandaled foot he rubbed out carefully the signs he had been tracing on the ground. Chapter 8, Shadows of the Future. It was shortly before midnight when I sought the house of Jalal ad-Din. It had readily been pointed out to me in the evening, but I found that no one was anxious to tell me much about its owner. All men seemed to fear if not to dislike him, and while they told me he was wealthy and learned they forbore, with the caution of Orientals, to express any opinion as to his moral character, and I could perceive that my inquiries for him had caused me to be regarded with suspicion. Jalal ad-Din's dwelling was a large low stone building, with one lofty tower rising from the middle, and affording a magnificent view of the stars by night and of the flat, slightly undulating country by day. It was situated in a retired part of the city, close to one of the outer walls, and was surrounded by a large uncultivated garden enclosed by very high walls, all these circumstances tending to add to its seclusion and to the mystery enveloping the character of its owner. My summons at the gate was answered by a Nubian slave, who was indeed the sorcerer's sole attendant, and I was conducted through the wilderness of a garden to a small door in a side wall near the tower. Here I was left while the slave announced me to his master. In a little he returned, and I was shown through a narrow passage to an anteroom, and then, into a large oblong apartment where Jalal ad-Din awaited me. The room betokened the character of its inmate, for instead of the rich hangings and luxurious cushions and soft carpets of a Persian house of that class, its walls were covered by strange objects of all kinds. The skulls and bones of animals and men, the dried bodies and skins of reptiles, huge vampire bats, and strange beasts. Bundles of dried herbs and gigantic tropical plants and grasses hung on the walls, intermixed with long rows of shelves holding every variety of earthen jars, crucibles, and retorts, and huge vessels of rough metal containing various chemical and strangely perfumed mixtures, with lumps of rock, and specimens of various earths and stones, and crystals in the rough state, and the plumage of rare birds, all grouped together in strange confusion. Another wall was covered by little shelves holding rolls of parchment, carefully tied, and near these hung a curious-looking dress of filmy black gauze, spangled with small stars and queer hieroglyphics in gold thread, worked upon it by the deft hands of some embroideress. Beside this dress were two wands crossed, one tipped with gold and having a golden star on the top, and the other tipped with silver, and having a crescent intertwined with a triangle surmounting it. A couple of tiger skins were spread upon the floor before a large tripod, upon which some sweet-scented powder was burning. Dark curtains PF heavy silk hung before the doors and window, and in one corner of the room a low archway seemed to lead to a narrow stair giving access to the tower. In one corner, a small lamp was suspended, throwing a feeble glimmer of light across the room, and beside the lamp, seated upon a pile of cushions, was Jalal ad-Din himself. As the slave retired, the sorcerer arose and saluted me, saying to me in the Assyrian language, which my friend Abu Bathy taught me to understand, "I bid you welcome," and signing me to seat myself upon another pile of cushions beside his own. He produced a jar of rare wine and some costly sweetmeats and invited me to partake of his hospitality, adding that when we had broken bread together I would no longer, he felt sure, distrust him. He also suggested that for the future we should converse in the Assyrian tongue, since I understood it, in order that no chance eavesdropper should be able to overhear our remarks. "For," said he, "even in the house of Jalal ad-Din the walls have ears, and I perceive through yonder wall that my slave Taki is even now striving to learn the purpose with which you hast sought me, and it were well to use a language he doth not understand, since in this world one half of mankind is ever more intent upon attending to the affairs of their neighbors than looking well after their own, and he who would differ in his habits from those around him must expect to be surrounded by spies, and they who will speak evil of him are many. Were I to go forth now I should find Taki far from the door, and yet do I see that he is even now upon his knees before it, straining every nerve to hear us. Taki is but a wretched slave, a dog whom I might slay tomorrow, yet had not even the infinitesimal sound fly power to poison with its sting, although you may kill it the next instant. And such as Taki spread abroad throughout the streets the things done in secret within the chamber. Let us then converse in the Assyrian tongue, since it is mine own language and you also dost understand it." He then took the jar of wine and filled a cup, which was carved in a most beautiful manner from the pure rock crystal, and set round with gems whose priceless value my experience with the robbers enabled me to know. Having first put this to his own lips, he handed it to me, doing the same in like manner with the cakes and sweetmeats, to show in how high esteem and honor he held me. Having finished this repast, Jalal ad-Din arose, and taking the lamp he searched carefully the outer room, and fastened the door, doing the same with the one in the inner chamber where we sat. He then placed the lamp behind a screen where its light was scarcely visible, and returned to me, carrying in his hand a small round disc of polished black marble, whose surface reflected like a mirror. Across this he passed his hand several times, and placing it within a curiously wrought frame of gold, whereon were engraved numerous cabalistic signs, he gave it into my hands, saying, "Look now into this mirror, and say whether Jalal ad-Din had restored your powers of vision unto you." I took the black disc and held it between my hands, fixing my eyes upon it as I had been wont to do in the temple with the crystals given me by the priests, and as I did so a grey mist, like smoke, passed over the dark polished surface, a violent trembling seized my limbs, and a wind as of ice blew over me and seemed to freeze my blood, and stop for a moment the beating of my heart. As these feelings passed, the face of the black mirror became clear, and I beheld a face, a man's face. Oh! Powers of evil, can any mere words describe that face, or paint at once its majestic beauty and its awful fiend-like expression? The eyes were fixed upon mine own, and as I gazed steadily upon them, they looked back in answer to my questioning thoughts. The face varied in its expression, and the lips moved, though no sound came from them, and I seemed to sense, rather than hear, each word as it was spoken. It appeared to say, "You ask who am I? Behold! I am the angel of darkness whom you did see upon the desert plain. No veil hides now my face, and since you canst thus steadily return my gaze, I know that you hast courage to behold the wonders of my sphere, wonders, which my servant Jalal ad-Din shall reveal unto you." The lips ceased to move, the eyes closed, the dark filmy veil covered again the face, which faded slowly away, leaving the black surface of the mirror clear again. I could not move a limb. I could make no motion even with my eyes, which were fixed in a stony stare upon the mirror, even as I myself was fixed like a rigid statue to the spot whereon I stood. Again the mist passed over the dark mirror, and this time it showed to me a woman's face, beautiful as the dawn, lovely as some fallen peri of paradise. I say as of some fallen peri, for she bore upon her brow that blood-red star, which is the symbol of the fallen angels, and amidst her dark hair the star of darkness gleamed as a jewel in a diadem. Her glorious eyes were veiled by long dark lashes, yet their gleam of passionate love transfixed my own as the magnetic glance of a snake doth fascinate a bird. Her cord lips were wreathed in smiles, yet were they as the smiles of one who can entrance but never charm, and her expression was that of a refined and subtle sensuality, as evil as ever marked the looks of the most ensnaring siren of the lowest hell. Her features were perfect in all their proportions, delicately chiseled as a statue of purest alabaster, and lovely as the spirit of a dream. But over all there hung the same stamp of subtly suggested evil, lurking one knew not where, yet marring to the eyes of the spirit the beauty, which charmed the senses. As I continued to gaze, her face seemed to cease to smile, it leered at me, and her furnace was like a mask that hid the treacherous nature of the soul. But in spite of this, my heart was stirred with the most violent passion, the most intense desire to possess her, which was as far as the wide poles are asunder from that pure and beautiful ideal of love, which I had hitherto cherished and which Dilfarib had so utterly failed to satisfy. And while I looked upon this woman, I knew that she was no mere vision, nor even a disembodied spirit that I beheld, but a living, breathing inhabitant of earth, whose life would yet be linked unto my own, for that in the book of our destinies, so it was even written, my intense desire to touch this woman caused me to lift my hand, when lo! The spell, which held me was broken and all vanished from my sight. The low mocking laugh of Jalal ad-Din broke upon my ear, and as I turned almost fiercely upon him in my disappointment, he said in a tone of great bitterness, and with the slow measured speech as of one in a dream, "Yea, even so it is with you. The charm of love is still the potent spell. You hast not tasted yet of its hollowness? You hast not learned how the fires of passion can sear and wither up the heart, till naught but its empty shell is left. Take up the mirror once again, and I will show you other things more worthy man's ambition." Mechanically I turned to look at the black disc again, and once more the smoke-like mist passed across its surface and the cold breeze chilled my blood and stopped the beating of my heart. But the feelings were fainter, and the pictures more dim and indistinct, not clear as before, for I had broken the threads of communication between myself and the other world, and the visions were marred by the hasty joining of the links. As pictures traced in smoke, I first saw a man seated upon a winged horse, with a winged helmet upon his head and a spear held out before him, as though he charged upon a foe. I saw him fall from his horse and lie trampled in the dust, while a whole legion of warriors appeared to ride over his prostrate body. Then I saw the man and horse arise and spread their wings, and soar away beyond the power of my sight to follow. I saw a woman draped all in somber black, lie writhing upon the ground in mortal agony, yet not able to die. I saw her drag herself along the ground of what seemed a narrow passage like a tomb, and tear with her fingernails at the hard walls, and dig like a wild beast at the hard ground, in frantic efforts to get out, till I could bear the sight no longer, and then she vanished. I saw a man lie dying on a bed, surrounded by many courtiers, and many slaves, yet calling always for someone who came not unto him. I saw this picture give place unto another, wherein there was a throne, and three figures contended for it. First one sat thereon, then seemed to fall from it and lie writhing on the ground in the fearful agony of violent death. Then the second figure ascended the steps of the throne, but ere he could seat himself, I saw him stagger and cast his arms up as though fighting many foes, ere he fell dead beside the throne. Then I saw the third man cast himself in the royal chair, and a curtain fell between him and myself. Next I saw a procession of veiled figures pass me, all turning away their heads as they drew near, till one woman came, and raised her veil, and I beheld the face of a woman of exceeding beauty, the beauty of the late summer of life, the mature charms of one past youth yet handsome still. But the face, though handsome, was cruel, and her glance seemed to wither my heart and turn my blood to ice. She gave me a mocking triumphant smile of vindictive hate ere she let fall her veil and passed on. And last of all, I saw a black figure crawl like a snake along the ground toward me, and as I gazed, it seemed to spit out its venom at me, and show me the face of a black slave, quite unknown to me, as else were all the figures in my visions. This last picture vanished. I raised my eyes from the mirror, and behold, the room was full of misty forms, human and yet inhuman in their shapes, dim as smoke wreaths, yet nonetheless distinct and palpable to my sight. They floated round Jalal ad-Din and myself, yet they touched us not, nor came within the circle around us. In Jalal ad-Din's hand he held the mystic wand, tipped with the triangle and the crescent, which he extended at arm's length to keep them back, uttering some words in a tone of command, in a strange unknown tongue. And as he waved them away they receded from us, and vanished like a cloud of dark mist, till Jalal ad-Din and I stood there alone. Chapter 9. My evil genius. The day was breaking as I left the house of Jalal ad-Din, and the contrast between the clear light shed around by the rapidly rising sun, and the dark mysterious room, which I had left, was like that between good and evil. Yet even as I saluted the orb of day, true symbol of purity and life, I did not waver in my determination to accept the offer, which the sorcerer had made me. I had opened the book of forbidden mysteries and looked within, and it was impossible for me to close it again till I had learned the knowledge contained within its pages. The very dangers involved in its pursuit gave to it only an added zest to my adventurous spirit. For what bold explorer of unknown paths was ever yet deterred from following them out by a knowledge of the treacherous nature of the ground he sought to traverse? Everyone believes that in some fashion luck will especially befriend him, and that where others have met destruction, he will yet be safe. It is of the very nature of such studies as Jalal ad-Din was engaged upon, that their fascinations once felt cannot again be shaken off. I accepted the sorcerer's proposals the more readily because he, reading aright my haughty, impetuous temper, ever impatient of control, sought to impose no open restrictions upon my perfect freedom of life. He invited me to join him as an equal, a friend and a pupil, and allowed me to cheat myself with the belief that therefore neither my mind nor my body would be subject to him in any way. And yet, had I not been already blinded by the strong magnetic attraction exercised by this man, and dominated by his masterful intelligence, I should have realized how powerful was the spell he had cast over me, and how completely his will had subordinated mine, so that, to all appearance free, I was in truth his slave already. I brought my horse with me to Jalaluddin's house, and suffered no one but myself to attend to the faithful animal, no other hand but my own to touch it. And many were the long rides I enjoyed, as we sped like the wind across me wide plain. Had I been asked to resign my horse and live shut up, as in the days I spent in the temple of Amurat, I should soon have wearied of the confinement, but Jalaluddin, in his wisdom, sought not to trammel the freedom of my movements, and I came and went as I listed, rode or studied as I felt inclined. All he exacted from me was an oath that under no circumstances, while my life on earth should last, would I impart to another the mysteries I had learned from him, an oath, which I faithfully kept during my mortal life, and, which I only break now because Jalaluddin himself no longer desires that I should keep it. My master devoted himself first to instructing me in the various methods of using my psychic powers, and showed me how to make them subordinate to my will. In the temple I had been the blind, often the unconscious, instrument whose powers were used by others. Jalaluddin taught me how to use them myself, and initiated me into the mystery of leaving my body at will and roaming through the spirit spheres, and holding communion with their inhabitants. He warned me, however, never to attempt this unless he was with me, as I had not yet attained to the degree of knowledge and power, which would render me safe in doing so. I pressed him very earnestly to give me this knowledge, but he would not do so, although he promised that later on he would in all respects satisfy my desires. He declared that as yet the time had not fully come when it could be imparted to me, and I felt when he said this what I had felt more than once before, that he showed me enough to make me of use to himself, and to whet my appetite for more, yet always held in his own hands a certain reserve of knowledge, which kept me dependent upon him. He would send my disembodied spirit to visit certain places and people of whom he desired to obtain secret information, and was able to obtain from me perfectly clear descriptions of what I beheld or heard, although I myself, on waking from my semi-trance, only retained a confused consciousness of where I had been. Not till long afterwards did I learn to what use he put the knowledge he gained. When I first saw Jalaluddin, I thought, as I have said, that he was about 40 years of age, but when I came to know him, I changed this estimate, for 10 times 40 years would not have sufficed for the accumulation of all the knowledge and experience which he had acquired, and I was not surprised to learn that he was one of those strangely gifted beings who, having discovered the secret of how to defy the assaults of time, and arrest the decay of the earthly body, are able to prolong their earthly lives for an indefinite period. What this secret was, he did not impart to me, nor did he show any desire to speak of his past history, but from many little circumstances I gathered that there had been incidents in that past, which filled his soul with intense bitterness towards all in a position above him, and gave him an antagonistic feeling to most of his kind. And while he thirsted always for more and more power to control the forces of the unseen universe around him, it was chiefly in order that through their aid, he might humiliate the powerful rulers of men who sought his help, or whom he was able indirectly to influence. Jalaluddin's occupations were many and secret, and his wonderful reputation for skill both as a magician and as a practitioner of medicine, was due to no mere charlatanism, but to a real and profound knowledge, not only of the anatomy of the human body, but of chemistry, and the action of the various drugs, which he prescribed. He carried on a perfectly legitimate and even beneficial business in curing many people of wounds and diseases which would have appeared to be fatal, and while he exacted a handsome reward for these services from the rich, he gave time and skill for nothing to those who were poor, and was ever generous in assisting the truly unfortunate, so that he had fairly earned the title given him by many of the good doctor. Well would it have been for him and his immortal welfare if he had confined the use of his power to such ends, but with the paradoxical contradictions of this man's strange character, he was as ready, or even more so, to use his skill in furthering an evil as a good purpose, and were the payment made to him sufficient to tempt a strange avaricious love of hoarding, which he showed, he would kill even more readily than cure. He had a large number of clients who sought his aid either to remove troublesome rivals or to blight the prospects of those against whom some spite was cherished. He also sold certain love potions, which really did cause those who drank them to exhibit, at all events for a time, the most intense passion for one towards whom they had previously shown indifference or dislike. He cast spells over some, and sold charms and amulets to others, which certainly appeared to possess the virtues he claimed for them. To my inquiry whether there was indeed power in the drugs he sold, and the charms and spells he cast, he replied with his sardonic smile, "In the little phial I gave to yonder lovesick maid who had but just left us there was naught but a little water and some drops of a powerful drug, which soothes the nerves and calms the brain, and produces that pleasing sensation of repose, which is the first essential to the thorough enjoyment of amorous thoughts. But that phial and its contents have been subjected to my magnetic influence, and have absorbed so much of my personality that they now form a focus to which my thoughts can travel, as on a slender thread of magnetic communication. I can thus project my will unto the person who has drunk of my drug, and I can cause him or her to feel the sensations I desire they should feel, in a greater or less degree, according as I am able to enter into their sphere, and then in very truth, they will exhibit those emotions which I have desired that they should show. They will feel sorry or glad, ill or well, at my bidding." And with his amulets and charms it was the same. In them there would be certain chemical properties calculated to assist the effects he desired, but it was the intellect and powerful will of the sorcerer himself which gave them their strongest virtue. The powerful magnetism of a man like Jalal ad-Din once imparted to a wand or ring or other article will remain so long as the object lasts in an entire state, or until a more potent influence is brought to bear upon it. It is this magnetic influence which constitutes the peculiar virtue of these charms, because it makes of the object so magnetized a powerful focus of attraction for a number of astral creatures of every kind. These, being once attracted to the object, cling to it, much as iron does to lodestone, and the possessor of one of the magic, or magnetic, charms can, if he but possess the requisite knowledge, use the astral beings who have been brought under the dominion of the original possessor's influence to carry out any desire which he, the actual holder of the charm, may wish. Many a time have I beheld these phantasmal beings hovering around Jalal ad-Din and myself as we sat poring over ancient parchments, which he had obtained from the archives of magicians who had long since passed from their earthly bodies, but whose magnetic influence still clung around these embodiments of their thoughts and studies. But as I only beheld these astral beings dimly, and as the explanations of their nature and powers which Jalal ad-Din gave me were mixed with a good deal of error as well as much truth, I shall reserve my account of them till the second half of my story, when I myself beheld them with the clear unveiled eyes of the spirit, and learned how difficult was the attempt to study them from the mortar side of life, where the earthly envelope imposes so many restrictions on the sight and hearing of the soul. See note I as to obsessions. It is not given to many mortals to behold these astral forms of life at all. The faculty which would enable man to do so is seldom found in more than the germ state during the life of the soul in the spheres of that planet upon which it has found incarnate life. Many spirits who have passed the first stage of earthly existence cannot even perceive them. They assure those mortals with whom they communicate that such forms of life do not exist, their limited knowledge, and ignorance that it is limited, preventing them from realizing that a still more etherealized form of sight than they, even as spirits possess, may be needful to show these things, which are invisible to them, even as the things of the spirit world are invisible to mortal eyes. To behold clearly, and to judge truly, the nature of these aerial phantoms of the astral plane requires a peculiar and very irksome process of development, which few mortals would care to undergo, while fewer still possess the needful qualities of super-refined soul sight. That which has been denominated astral matter exists not alone in the spheres around the planets but extends through all the universe, constituting in fact a hitherto unrecognized element of that universe,